Welcome back to the WinPower News Review with me, Claire Warren, editor of WinPower Monthly.
And me, Ian Griggs, deputy editor of WinPower Monthly. We're back with our regular panel of experts for their take on the big stories from our recent news coverage.
Today, we'll quiz our panellists for their views on the big Western turbine manufacturers' quarterly and full year results, and we'll ask what they tell us about the relative health of the wider wind industry.
In the wake of publishing their financial results, several turbine firms and developers have announced they will narrow their focus and concentrate on specific markets going forward. But how long will this continue, and what does this mean for the markets which are not chosen?
Following their joint award of the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering last month, wind industry pioneers Henrik Stiesdal and Andrew Garrard told WinPower Monthly that the so-called turbine arms race must stop. But is anyone listening, especially developers?
Finally, a host of geopolitical events are exerting pressure on the wind industry, from the continuing war in Ukraine to attacks on merchant shipping in the Red Sea. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is now the presumptive Republican nominee in the forthcoming elections. But can the US wind market survive another Trump presidency?
It's all on the latest News Review podcast, a regular series in addition to our episodes exploring the issues in the wind industry today. Joining us for the News Review to discuss some of the biggest industry stories in February, we welcome back our regular panellists, Will Sheard and Shashi Bala. Will is Director of Analysis and Due Diligence at consultancy firm K2 Management. Hi, Will.
Hi, nice to be back. Good to see you all.
And Shashi is Director and Head of Research in Renewable Energy at the Brinkman Group.
Hello, good to be back as well.
Thanks for joining us again, Shashi and Will. We're looking forward to getting your views on this month's topics. Western turbine manufacturers and developers released financial results last month. And among the full year results for the OEMs, Vestas returned to profit, while Nordex and GE both narrowed their losses. Meanwhile, Siemens Gamesa also narrowed its losses in its quarterly results. But it was a more mixed picture for the developers. Spanish giant Iberdrola recorded a surge in profits, but the Danish developer Ørsted made substantial losses. Shashi, what do the latest set of quarterly and full year results tell us about the relative health of the wider wind industry?
I think the profitability is increasing in general for the industry, especially for the upstream players, compared to 2022, where the top four companies that you mentioned, they've registered a loss of about 5.3 billion euros in 2022, and that has lowered marginally to 4.8 billion euros. And a substantial improvement for Vestas and improvement for GE and Nordex. However, the combined four players is down because of the 4 billion hit on a calendar year basis for Siemens Gamesa. So that dragged down the OEMs in general. But I think we have seen that 2023 is kind of an inflection point for the industry. The order intake is a good reflection of the future profitability of the companies. Until 2022, we have seen in the last 5 years that the orders declined by 40%. And that was kind of a double-edged sword, because when they were executing the orders in 22 and 23, where their volumes have gone down by 40%, and at the same time, the cost have shot up by 40, 50%.
Right.
But companies managed well. Of course, there is still a lot of work to be done, but we can already see a recovery in orders, which is very, very promising. For example, Vestas onshore was up by 50%, and Siemens offshore was up by 250%, and Nordex as well is up by 25%. So I think there is a good momentum in the market in terms of commercial order intake, and that will be translated into profitability in the next few years. It's a mixed picture for the developers because of the exposure that the developers carry in different markets. Ørsted had a 2 billion profits and then roughly over 2 billion in losses. So a margin digression of by 4 billion if you look at the value deterioration. And that is largely stemming from the write-off in the U.S. market. So that's $2.3 billion write-off in one single project. On the downstream side, many regulators around the world are now increasing the prices, whether it is for onshore or it is offshore, which means that the developers would bid for higher PPA prices and having a better rate of return on the projects that they're going to develop. And they can also accommodate the increased prices from the turbine OEMs. So I would expect that both the developers and the suppliers would increase their profit margins going forward. However, not all the companies would come out of the woods in the single year. We were expecting that Vestas would make some wafer thin margin in 23 and GE also by 25, and Siemens would probably one of the last ones to come out of the woods by 2026.
It's that staggered recovery, which you've mentioned before, isn't it? They will eventually get there, but it's going to be in stages.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because of market challenges and as well as internal challenges. But until companies are doing something terribly wrong, then nothing should prevent them from seeing that recovery in the profit pools going forward.
So if one looks behind the bold numbers, the headline figures, your analysis there is that the broad outlook is actually pretty encouraging for the near future.
Absolutely.
Which is good to know. In the wake of the financial results, Ørsted said it was pulling out of offshore wind markets such as Norway, Portugal and Spain, and deprioritising development in Japan as part of a review of its portfolio. Despite its stronger position, Iberdrola said its approach to offshore wind this year will be committed but selective. Among the turbine firms, Siemens Gamesa has already said that it intends to focus on the European market for onshore wind. And GE Vernova said it will be highly selective about adding to its offshore wind order backlog while the industry begins to reset following the turbulent 2 years that we've had. Will, why do you think wind companies are being more selective and narrowing their focus?
I think the Ørsted pulling out of the US is a really good example of where the developers are seeing that the markets aren't necessarily moving as quickly as they expected. I think a lot of the economic challenges, the inflationary shocks, the commodity price increases, etc., have made developing offshore wind projects more challenging and less profitable. And so companies are having to be more selective about where they can be successful based on their own capabilities and existing track record. I think it's an indication, at least, that some of these developers were sort of overextended into all new markets and are realizing that they can't do everything everywhere. And so having to be more sensible, more strategic about where they focus is a good thing. And what we can see, particularly in announcement from Ørsted, is that they know which markets fit their capabilities and which markets are maybe a little bit less certain. And so they want to focus on those markets where they can perform and where they can be more certain that projects will be developed and built in the coming years. With the US, Japan, Norway, these are still emerging markets for offshore wind, and there's still quite a bit of uncertainty about how those projects actually come to completion. I think this is company strategy in action. I think it's fundamentally a good thing.
Do you have a sense of what impact that might have on targets and the rate at which we see installation go up?
I think it will be a slowdown, but I don't think it's necessarily being driven by the appetite of developers. I think developers will fill the gap which is left available by the policy on the one side and the supply chain on the other. If the national policies can be strengthened to allow the capacity to be constructed and that the supply chain can step up to produce the equipment required, perhaps developers can scale up more easily than the other two key stakeholders I mentioned to fill those gaps. To answer your question, Claire, I think it will slow it down for now because there will be less project in the pipeline fundamentally. But I think the developers will adapt to fill in the available capacity.
Later on in our podcast, we plan to get onto European policy, but this one comes up time and time again, doesn't it? That we are to a certain extent reliant on governments and what they do to help the wind industry.
Yes, and I think while we do have a finite resource and a finite capacity in the industry, I think there is an element of international competition between nations to fight for and attract that capacity. And perhaps the US, for example, has not demonstrated itself as a super attractive market. And so the likes of Ørsted are like, okay, maybe we should focus on Germany, focus on the UK, focus on where we know and understand.
Shashi, you're good at future gazing. Let me put this to you. Should we expect this trend of narrowed focus to continue throughout the year with further consolidation and focus on key markets?
Even some of the tier one developers, they're developing cold feed in some of the established market, and Australia is a good example of that. And so is Iberdrola also being selective. And if you look at the downstream players developing those projects, there is a demarcation based on their financial strategies. So the companies with a higher financial risk appetite and the oil and gas companies, their appetite is slightly higher, because their weighted average cost of capital is lower compared to some of the incumbents and pure play developers and IPPs. So those companies are slightly aggressive, and that's what we have seen in Germany and in the other markets as well, where some of the pure play incumbents, the likes of Ørsted is a great example, they are now being more selective, because they know that what is their cost of capital, and they have a decent IRR expectations, and they want to pull out of all those markets where the risk is high. Many developers have spread their wings far too thin and exposed themselves into a lot of new emerging markets. So now it would be a risky proposition for those developers to incur the development expenditure on those projects which may have some policy bottlenecks. I would expect that the consolidation will further continue among these companies and markets. But if you look broadly in the wind industry, today we are talking about 40 markets where turbines are installed on an annual basis. By the end of this decade, we're going to see 80 plus markets installing turbines every single year. So despite some of those short-term or mid-term challenges, developers are still looking out for the long-term prospects in this sector.
And I'm interested to know, Shashi, what you think is going to happen to the countries or even regional markets which are not chosen by Western wind companies to be part of their narrowed focus. Is there a danger that they might be left behind? Will was talking earlier about attracting capital to the right places. What are these markets which are not chosen going to do?
This gap will be largely filled by Chinese suppliers. If you think about the addressable market for most of the developers and the OEMs alike, it's mainland Europe and North America. Rest of the other markets, they're less active in those markets, and that gap is filled by the Chinese players. If you think about Austria pulling out in markets like Vietnam 8 months ago, that is actually now filled by the Chinese. 3 years ago, 80% of the supply was by the Western OEMs, and today 80% of the supply there is by the Chinese OEMs and Chinese IPPs investing into that market. And the same thing is seen in some of the high-risk markets like in Middle East and Africa. It is the Chinese IPPs that are locking in investments. So they are flooding those markets with billions of dollars, raising cheap capital and then developing those projects. The same is seen in Latin America to a certain degree as well. So all the markets that the Western developers are less interested in, that is largely filled by the Chinese players.
That's really interesting that the Chinese companies are going to be essentially rushing to fill those gaps, which should perhaps give Western wind companies pause for thought. Let's talk a bit about an increasingly perennial subject in the news review, which is the turbine arms race. Last month, the wind industry pioneers Henrik Stiesdal and Andrew Garrard were recipients of the Queen Elizabeth Prize for Engineering, which recognizes those responsible for, quote, groundbreaking innovations that have been of global benefit to humanity, and really couldn't think of two more deserving winners for that. But in a subsequent interview with us on Wind Power Monthly, both men said the turbine arms race was harming the industry and it should stop, although they differed on how that should be achieved. Will, there are some big industry voices now who are in favour of stopping this relentless arms race towards bigger and bigger and bigger. But can Western turbine firms escape the inexorable logic of developers demanding more powerful machines for their projects?
Yeah, it's certainly a perennial topic, and I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon. I worked at Siemens Wind Power for a few years during the time when the 5 and 6 megawatt direct drive platform was being launched. And I remember Henrik saying at the time that that was probably close to the limit of turbine capacity. So, you know, things move on, and I think he acknowledged that even his forecasts have been flawed in the past. We've certainly come a long way, and we're certainly still on that path. I've said before that the current scale of wind turbine capacities in the sort of, you know, circa 15 megawatt range, maybe a little bit higher, you know, allows for gigawatt scale wind farms to be built. It's a technology which can be sort of optimized and developed and can be sort of well utilized, and I think would allow for the majority of the currently foreseen wind energy projects in the world to be built. I think that developers would be happy with a smaller catalogue of available wind turbines that allow them to build their projects at an appropriate level of profitability, etc. And I think also for governments, it would be helpful for them to have more static foresight in what projects need in terms of policy, revenue support, etc. So I think most parties would be happy to see a slowdown. What that removes, however, is competition. And it remains true that larger turbines tend to provide a better economic case for offshore wind farms. And so that means there will be this pressure for turbine suppliers to offer larger turbines to remain competitive, for developers to seek out the largest turbines. And while we have the Chinese OEMs pushing the boundaries, announcing larger and larger turbines, it's difficult for European OEMs, the more established offshore wind developers, to ignore that and say, you know, we're not going to engage in that game. And I don't see a way currently that that consensus can form to effectively force that to happen.
That's where Henrik Stiesdal and Andrew Garrard differ, isn't it? Henrik Stiesdal says an external limit should be imposed. So governments should say this far and no further. And then the turbine firms can effectively relax and get on with it. Whereas Andrew Garrard says, no, you can't impose restrictions from above. It's got to be a natural agreement between the turbine manufacturers. Could I push you to say which side of that argument you tend towards, a consensus amongst turbine firms or an external limit imposed upon them because they can't decide?
I probably lean maybe a little bit more towards the former argument. I think we've said a lot in the past that there will be a technical limit to the size of wind turbines, which has been consistently smashed apart,
yeah, exactly.
as we've moved up in the scale of wind turbines. So I'm not convinced for now that there is a technical limitation to the size of wind turbines, which brings us to the formal version. Could that be having a cap on maximum tip heights, some less engineering driven restriction? I think would work for sure. That could be applied by individual governments. The risk is that there needs to be a certain consensus within a reasonably large group of offshore wind market players to say, if, say, European countries said, you know, we're going to put a 250-meter, 300-meter tip height limit on new turbines, that would cap the scale of turbines. And that would probably work. The question is, to what extent does that limit the competitive advantage of those countries if other countries are not applying those restrictions and potentially able to either build and generate wind energy at more competitive prices and potentially be a more attractive market for developers and the supply chain if that's where they can go and sell their best technology? So yeah, it's a really difficult question.
That's why I asked you.
Well, exactly. I'm probably generally not so keen on somewhat arbitrary government intervention, but at the same time, I do think that that's probably the best direction to go.
It goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about perhaps the difference between the Western and the Eastern OEMs. Sany has announced that it's testing blades which would be suitable for a 30 megawatt turbine, which of course is enormous and way, way, way bigger than the kind of conversations we've been having about maximums for the Western market. Shashi, what do you think that tells us about the direction of travel for the Chinese turbine manufacturers? And why do we think maybe that there is such an obvious split between the Eastern and the Western manufacturers on the turbine arms race?
The dynamics in China are way different than what we see in the rest of the world. In China, they've introduced about 80 different turbine variants in 2023. And just think about the Western world, they had zero in 2023. And 2022 is about 8 product variants. And in the offshore as well, There's hardly any new announcements. Of course, now GE has come up with the extended variant of the Halyard X machine. But in China, we have seen that about 37 new turbine product variants are announced. They're lower compared to 2022 because right after the feed-in tariffs, there was a rush to introduce next generation technologies. They were quantum leaping from 6-7 megawatts to 12-13 megawatts. Now they are slowly transitioning to the 16 plus megawatt turbines, but that has slowed down, which means that they're already reaching some sort of maturity in the Chinese market that they would indirectly arrive at a consensus on. However, it is probably will never arrive at a stage where everybody will slow down those product developments completely because the innovation in itself has driven the cost down. And why should companies slow down that innovation? Because they will face some of the challenges. But it is one of the reasons why industry is successful. It's one of the pillars that would drive the industry forward. So we're going to see that dissimilarities in the Chinese companies and also in the Western companies in terms of approach. And in China, we forecast last year they've installed 6 gigawatts and then probably will grow by fivefold, sixfolds by the next 10-year outlook period. And if you look at it as the single biggest market in terms of volume, and there are good enough players in China that would want to get a share in that market. So that's one of the reasons why Chinese companies are aggressively launching next generation technologies. One of the good reasons of SANY as well. The tier one turbine OEMs are focused on the conventional platforms and gradually scaling them up because they already have the track record. While the tier two and tier three Chinese OEMs are very aggressive because they don't have the track record. They need to go and prove to the market. And the best way for them to prove it is try to introduce a larger rated turbine. And that's one of the reasons a lot of tier two, tier three turbine OEMs are aggressively pitching in 15 plus, 20 plus megawatt turbines in China. I would not expect that it would slow down anytime soon, but certainly they would also reach the commercial threshold. I mean, you also need to make money in the supply chain because the subsidies are gone in China. And I would expect that in the next few years, it would also slow down in the Chinese market as well.
I hope you're enjoying this episode of the Wind Power Podcast. But before I ask our guest the next question, here's a quick word from one of our sister titles, and then we'll be right back.
Did you know that 1 in 6 species in Great Britain are at risk of extinction? My name is James Ajapong Parsons, and I'm the producer of The Eco Chamber, a weekly podcast that investigates the deep-rooted issues facing our country's natural environment and the policy that underpins them. We give you the facts, insights, and exclusives that no other podcast can. The Eco Chamber, digging deep into stories that matter. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's move on to geopolitical events. After Russia launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February 2022, the EU responded in a variety of ways, including by tabling a raft of measures intended to speed up the energy transition and reduce dependence on Russian gas. These included the Repower EU plan, which set ambitious installation targets and put renewables on an overriding public interest footing. There was also the Net Zero Industry Act, which is currently nearing final agreement, which requires member states to support the industry via inflation protection mechanisms and auction designs. But there's been pushback on both a political and a public level. Member states voted against a measure in the Net Zero Industry Act, which would have required them to contribute public funds for supply chain manufacturing. There have been protests by farmers in Europe against so-called environmental red tape, and the European Commission and Parliament are expected to swing to the right following elections later this year, which of course has potential implications for the emphasis on renewables. Will, 2 years on from the invasion of Ukraine, do you think the EU's political and even public consensus on the energy transition is still intact? Do we still see the same unity amongst member states?
I think that there have always been a number of member states who have been very pro-renewables and some who have been less so. And I think we'd probably still see that division. The energy transition away from Russian gas, which was accelerated by the invasion of Ukraine, has instigated some very positive steps. But a real action that we've seen is a shift towards LNG imports rather than Russian pipeline imports. It probably has had some influence on auction processes and pipeline, but in terms of an actual increase in installed capacity, I don't think we've necessarily seen that yet. I think there is still a consensus within the European Union that renewable energy is the priority. And I think we should probably dislocate some of the more environmental policies that are being applied around sort of, you know, agriculture and other industry. But it's at least sensible to talk about, you know, who's funding these activities and the acceleration of the industry, because where individuals and governments are financially constrained with the sort of cost of living crisis, it does shine a spotlight on expensive government intervention, whether that's at a national level or higher. It's natural that these things come under scrutiny. That probably goes hand in hand with a rightward shift in government makeups as well. But I hope and expect that the European Union will remain committed to renewable energy. What I hope even more is that the industry is moving into a phase where less and less government intervention is required. We are maturing quickly, and yeah, of course, will always require policies that support the industry. But I hope that the amount of actual money that's required becomes lower and lower, and that the advantages of cleaner electricity generation, job creation, technology and innovation and development, all of those additional benefits will be seen in aggregate, you know, as a positive influence on countries and regions.
As well as energy security itself, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's probably the primary point when we're talking about moving away from Russian energy imports, particularly in the UK, where I have most expertise in what the government's saying and the national policies. Energy security is a big factor. When you look at trying to convince the populace when finances are tight, that's probably an easier argument to make than slightly less tangible impacts like cleaner air, job creation, technology development, these kinds of things. Although as an environmentalist, fundamentally, I think climate change as an issue is even bigger. And so I would hope that that is a legitimate argument to make to people. But I think we know that that is maybe not quite so simple as that.
But it's that difference, isn't it, between this not so slow moving is becoming more and more visible all around us, next to something where you can actually see it tangibly, even if you have no truck whatsoever with the environmental movement. You can see the spike in your energy bill prices and the reason for that. Let's move on to another big geopolitical event. Donald Trump has consistently trounced his Republican challengers during almost all of the US primaries last month, culminating in his last remaining rival, Nikki Haley, pulling out of the race earlier this week following Super Tuesday. This leaves Trump, who is notorious for his antipathy towards wind power, the presumptive Republican nominee for the coming presidential elections in November. That's bound to make some in the wind industry nervous about the outcome of that race. Shashi, what do you think a second Donald Trump administration could mean for US turbine manufacturers such as GE, also the attractiveness of that market for the wider wind industry?
Certainly, there's some element of risk whenever there's somebody like Trump who is publicly vocal about his negative sentiment towards wind industry. However, need to get a buy-in from the Senate. When the Obama administration sealed the four-year extension of the PTC and the ITC, even when Trump took over, he was also quite publicly vocal, mentioning that they were going to repeal those policies. But he couldn't succeed, and the industry flourished after that. Now, to the current legislation, I would expect that it would continue in its current shape or form. Possibly, there would be some minor tweaks to the legislation, might not be entirely repealed in its full form. So that's some downside risk that we see in the market. However, you know, when we look at the investment sentiment for the industry, GE has a bigger influence than anybody else in the sector on the US policies, especially when it comes to wind industry. GE is retreating from many markets, you know, cutting down from 20 markets to 10 markets in the current strategy. And GE is betting heavily on the US market, and it should, given the promise that the market is going to offer to them. When it comes to the broader market, globally, excluding China, US is by far the biggest market for developers and the suppliers alike. There is no single market that could contribute to that significant volume. If we exclude China, US contributes to roughly 30-35% of the global demand. So it is a substantially a big market. And it's the largest economy, a very, very stable economy. And combined with the policies, whether it is the IRA, or the favorable sentiment of the developers in investing into that market, it is expected to increase that positive momentum in the market. And we've already seen end of 23 that the developers are rushing towards investing into wind projects. And clean energy as a whole has a record year in the US last year. So the overall positive sentiment for the investments into the US market would continue to strengthen. Of course, there will be hiccups. Offshore wind, we have seen hiccups for Ørsted, and we have seen in New York and New Jersey taking a hard stance, but they've also revised the prices, and which is in favor of the developers. So broadly speaking, I would expect that this market would contribute to a significant chunk of the global excluding China market going forward.
Before we move on to the last question, which Claire's going to ask both of you, I'd love to hear your point of view on this. We're 8 months away from the election. Do you think it's going to be Biden or Trump who takes the White House?
It's always the number game. And it can swing in any way. One thing I would certainly acknowledge is Republicans are coming back stronger this time. But yeah, the final result, I would probably refrain from speculating on that.
And Will?
Yeah, I'm going to do the same thing, I'm afraid. But about, you know, the potential impact of a Trump presidency on the wind industry, I feel relatively optimistic that the general momentum in the industry and the state level power to influence the industry in individual states means that the industry, you know, should be able to continue, and that hopefully there's no disruptive legislation passed to sort of to really impact the industry.
Let's move on to other events that are having an impact on the wind industry. The crisis in the Red Sea with armed Houthi rebels targeting merchant shipping is not showing any signs of abating anytime soon. The attacks have forced shipping to take longer routes around Africa's Cape of Good Hope, which has impacted on the turbine manufacturers. During its financial results last month, Nordex admitted the attacks were already impacting its profitability. Enercon, Siemens Energy and Vestas have also expressed concerns over delays and associated costs. How seriously could these attacks on merchant shipping in the Red Sea affect the wind supply chain and profitability if they persist?
I don't want to downplay the general seriousness and unpleasantness of the situation in the Middle East, but I think that the impacts are fairly easily quantifiable in terms of the delay and increased shipping costs of potentially not being able to use the Suez Canal route and having to go around Africa, essentially. I've read that shipping costs increase sort of marginally by 5-10%, and the actual timing delay is of the order of 3 or 4 weeks. In most industries where, you know, margins are tight, that's going to have an impact on profitability. But I think they are relatively easily quantifiable. I hope that once we get through the initial shock, if shipping companies are, you know, moving away from the Suez Canal and taking the longer route round to Europe, that becomes the base case assumption, and that becomes that those can be built into the economic models and the plans for the project.
So one of those situations perhaps that even if it does persist in the longer term, the industry will adapt to a new normal?
I think so. Maybe coming back to the first question we had about the turbine suppliers' profitability, that was driven largely by commodity price inflations. I think they've peaked, but they haven't necessarily gone away. The turbine suppliers have been able to adapt to the new price structure that they're operating within. Taking a step away, this is just an additional inflationary pressure on the supply chain, if that makes sense.
Shashi, any final words on that?
In terms of the magnitude of the impact, it's not going to be very, very severe, but that impact would be felt differently by different companies. And especially the two things that's likely to influence this one is the turbine OEMs having significant supply chain centered in the Asian markets, especially from China. Secondly, if they're using parts from China to support the European markets, they need to incur that additional cost and time delays, whether it is 5, 10, 15%. So those two factors are the ones that we need to bake in when we're looking at what impact it has on the supply chain. And all the top five Western turbine OEMs have exposure to the Chinese supply chain. Enercon has the least exposure to China, and Vestas has the highest exposure. So the order and magnitude of impact could also probably in the same degree, and not necessarily at the same time, because having an exposure to China does not mean that they will be severely impacted. Maybe they're not shipping that components to Europe and they're shipping it to somewhere in Latin America or somewhere elsewhere in Asia-Pac. I would expect that, of course, it impacts their near-term profitability without a doubt, but it's not a significant cost escalator. Yes, it would become a new normal going forward.
Well, I think that's about all we have time for. Thanks very much indeed, Shashi Bala, for joining us.
Thank you, and happy to be, as always.
And thank you very much indeed, Will Sheard, for joining us as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much. Good conversation as usual.
Will, Shashi, thanks very much. You've been listening to the Wind Power News Review with Ian Griggs and Claire Warren, looking back at the big stories over the last 4 weeks. Make sure you subscribe to the Wind Power podcast so you never miss an episode. And do feel free to leave us a review. For more news, comment, and analysis on the wind industry, visit windpowermonthly.com.